The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. What would a New Zealand-born ex-Aussie resident know about Japan's most iconic national beverage? As it turns out, tapuri. That's plenty to you and I. Wayne Shannon is a certified sommelier, and he was also the first New Zealander to achieve certification as an advanced sake professional. He has worked in hospitality in Australia and New Zealand since 2002. And in 2019, Wayne and his Japanese wife, Makie, relocated to Japan to open a sake and wine bar, Rangitoto, Tokyo. The venture seemed well-timed to capitalise on the Rugby World Cup and the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. But Wayne and Makie could never have predicted that other global event. Wayne is also the author of the e-book, Demystifying Sake, which you can find on Amazon, and he has worked in sake breweries in Ishikawa, Saga and Gifu prefectures. On a mission to get more New Zealand and Australian wines into the hands of Japanese wine buffs, Wayne is also passionate about raising sake's undervalued reputation as the stuff of dodgy Hollywood binges. Tom Cruise has a lot to answer for there. I asked Wayne how Japanese sake piqued his interest such that he came to devote his career to the beverage.
The thing with sake, and this was definitely what came up when I started getting into it, is there was very few people in the Southern Hemisphere, even, that kind of knew much about it outside this kind of cartoonish view of what it should be from semi-dodgy movies where everyone's just getting smashed on this stuff. And so one of the things that drew me to it was just that the perception is so far out from what the reality of the product is. And the brewers are working so hard to make this amazing product that people don't appreciate. There's such a big disconnect there that it needed somebody, or needs people to kind of step in and trying to fill the gap. And I sort of felt a certain sense of responsibility once I met some of these sake brewers who are at times working 19 hours a day for 2.5 months to make this product, that I sort of felt like they needed someone to help explain their story because they were clearly too tired to do it. And I guess the other thing is a lot of them, their English isn't so good. And if their English is good, maybe their marketing skills, they haven't had time to study up on those. So yeah, there was so much involved about the personal side and the lack of understanding side. But the other thing is, it is such a fascinating beverage with such a long history, and it's so good with food. It just needs, I guess, it needs that story to be told, I feel, and I sort of felt like I could maybe step in and help a little bit on that one.
When you mentioned just in passing there about portrayals in movies, like, is there anything specific you could think of, not just in movies, but how you've seen sake portrayed in Australia or outside of Japan?
There's a misunderstanding, I guess, in particular with those little cups, right? The little cups that sake are consumed from. So people from the West will often associate that with a shot glass and drink it like it's a shot. That's one of the sorts of things that has helped to perpetrate this misunderstanding about sake being a spirit. But the only movie that came to mind was actually The Last Samurai, where Tom Cruise is just complaining about being sober and is sort of screaming and shouting sake all the time. But I know I've seen other ones where people are dropping sake into beer and just drinking it, like, you know, 21st birthday parties or those sorts of things, like those
sake
kind of movies.
Bombs,
yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're drinking anything like that, you're probably drinking for maybe not the quality of the product as opposed to trying to get intoxicated. But It's an image sake has had, and this image is changing, I believe, a lot because of people like John Gottner. I believe you might have crossed paths with him in the past.
Yeah. But yes, on this podcast, actually.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, absolute legend of the sake industry. But that image is being rehabilitated back to where it should be. But yeah, it is. There's some work to do.
And at some point, you actually went as far as writing a book, didn't you? An e-book on sake. What was the spot in the market that you saw for that?
a practical, complete lack of competition. at the time, I mean, if you were thinking of writing a book about alcohol and you looked at how many things were available about wine, like just pick any of those hundreds of thousands. And when I finally... customers were basically saying, you should write a book about this because the way you're explaining it makes it really easy to understand. And so I finally kind of tried to think, what do I have to offer that John Gottner or Philip Harper, who's a brewer from Cornwall, who is one of the best master brewers in Japan, in my opinion. They've written a couple of books, but if you'd looked on Amazon at the time, I think there was less than 10. What I thought I could possibly bring to the table is I was talking to people who didn't come into the venue to drink sake. They came into the venue to eat Japanese food. And then they'd eat Japanese food and then they'd always just order what they always ordered. So my job was to just basically introduce them when they didn't expect to be introduced. As a sommelier, I kind of run on some certain basic assumptions about customers. And I think that most customers don't actually care about the details. They really just want to know if they like it or not. Quite often with sake, it seems, is people want to get across what makes sake unique. And then they start using terminology. And then eventually sometimes you're just kind of blinding people. They get lost. And I believe that ultimately most people don't care about that. They just want to know if they like it or not. And if they like it, then maybe you're going to trigger something which will mean that they can go off and look at deeper, more complex things and they can start to understand all of the background. And I sort of feel that that is one of the problems that we are having as an industry, is that we're trying to tell a unique story, but some of the times the unique story is too detail specific with language that's not necessarily everybody's mother tongue, that you just lose people at the beginning and then they kind of go, oh yeah, it sounds complicated, and then can I have a Chardonnay? And so I had developed, I guess, some parallels that I could pull from whatever beverage they were drinking, and I sort of figured, oh, that might be a good way to try and transfer that knowledge into a book. And I guess I was rereading it a little bit recently, and I'm less embarrassed about what I wrote than I thought I was going to be. So I might try and get that published properly fairly soon.
In terms of, like, generally speaking, you know, what kind of spot do you think that sake occupies in the market for people? Is it a wine substitute or a beer substitute or a spirit substitute? Where do you kind of see it sitting in reference to those other products that most people are going to be more familiar with?
I think it's an excellent question because, I mean, basically what I alluded to before, a lot of people have a fairly low expectation of what the product is because basically they might have had something at a venue that wasn't treated with respect, that might have been bulked out with cheap spirits and had flavors and additives, and then they tasted it, didn't like it, and then kind of went, oh, I don't like that category. But sake is very diverse, and especially recently, it's a really exciting time because much like a lot of craft beers, people are just, or some of the wine appellations, the brewers are sometimes saying, okay, I want to do this. The rules tell me I'm not allowed to. If I do, I can't put these words on the label, but I want to. So they just do it. And so you're finding all of these really, really cool sake-like products that aren't technically allowed to be called sake because they haven't followed the rules. If you're familiar with sort of the way that the wine laws were in Italy, the most expensive wines in Italy were considered table wines because they were made outside of the local rules, but they were still the best wines in Italy. I mean, personal preference, but they were phenomenal. And then eventually the law caught up to what the winemakers were doing. And in sake, there's a similar thing that's sort of happening. So if you look at the diversity of the product, it kind of brings me back to another one of my basic assumptions, is that, like, if you like alcohol, you like sake. There's something out there for you. It's that diverse that if you enjoy whiskey, then I'm sure we can find something for you that you're going to love. And if you like sparkling wine, there's some very, very good sparkling style sakes that have come out recently. And if you were going to go for something like a sweet, like a sticky wine, then there's sake that that I've done blind tastings for that people assumed was a sweet, sticky wine, but it's definitely sake.
You, at some point, made the decision to move to Japan and open Rangitoto Tokyo?
Yeah, Rangitoto Tokyo is...
Sorry, excuse my terrible pronunciation. I'll leave that to you.
Luckily, it's a little bit embarrassing, but being a New Zealander who learnt how to pronounce Māori words much better because of my understanding of the Japanese pronunciation, but Japanese and Māori are pronounced pretty much the same as far as the vowels and everything goes. So Rangitoto is the volcano that's out in the harbour in Auckland that you can see from most places of any height. There's a gap over here for Australasian wine, and part of our plan is to look at Australia as well, because neither countries get the respect for the wines that they deserve in this country. New Zealand and Australia make, in my mind, the best wine in the world, but very few people in this country know that. And the other thing is, it's actually hard to go into a venue and speak to somebody about sake quite often in Tokyo. Even if you go to a place that specializes in sake, quite often the people behind the counter aren't equipped to explain it. And if they can explain it, maybe not in English. So we decided to open up a bar, and coming into a Rugby World Cup and an Olympics, what could possibly go wrong?
Just a little global pandemic, nothing to worry about.
Oh yeah, we totally had a whole section in the business plan built into the pandemic. yeah, interesting times.
Let's just sort of go back to before you opened. I mean, how straightforward is it for a foreigner to go to Japan? And obviously your wife is Japanese, so that must have helped things. But what's involved in setting up a bar over there?
Yeah, well, she is Japanese, but I think these days she's probably more Kiwi, and we've definitely corrupted her sense of humour. Like most things in Japan, I think it is fairly straightforward, but the paperwork is insane, and this is where the main difficulty is, I think, for anyone trying to kind of do business in Japan. Is there's no grey area. It is a yes or it's a no. And in New Zealand and Australia, there's a lot more probable discretion involved for the people who are making certain decisions. But in Japan, the paperwork is king, you know. So not being able to read the kanji is probably the biggest problem, I think, that a non-Japanese person is going to deal with. Luckily, my wife is an accountant. She's also West at level 3 as well, so she's been getting into her wine study too. But having her there to kind of take care of all of those things as soon as we hit those walls was pretty necessary to get things up and running, especially in time to kind of catch the Rugby World Cup. But yeah, it is most things in this country, as far as I can tell, are pretty straightforward, but the paperwork has to be, everything has to be dotted and crossed, you know, and everything has to be countersigned and stamped. And if it's not, then you might have to start the process again with another person, which can be infinitely infuriating. But then once everything's where it should be, things can happen really, really quickly.
Were there any other headaches in getting set up?
Well, this is actually part of the opportunity. The structure over here is, I, as a purchaser, as a restaurant, bar, I cannot purchase directly from an importer. I have to purchase from a distributor. So if, for example, I have a friend in New Zealand who makes wine and I speak to them and I want to put their wine on the menu here, I have to ask them who their importer is. Then I have to get in touch with the importer and then say, who do you distribute through? And then I have to get in touch with my distributor and give them all of the information that I've collected. And then they will get in touch with the importer. And then finally, maybe I'll get the wine. What it doesn't take into account is quite often the distributors have no interest in wine. So like you're talking to somebody who just doesn't care or understand why you do what you do. And so it's frustrating. Over time, eventually I've been able to find most of the wines that I've wanted. But luckily, we've actually just got our import license coming through in a couple of days. So I'll be able to bypass those people and then hopefully we can do things a little bit more efficiently.
You touched on this before. What is the perception of Australian and New Zealand wine in Japan generally?
Unfortunately for Australia, because of the success of some of the more entry-level products, people don't realise that Australia necessarily makes the high-end stuff too. For example, I saw a bottle of Henschke Hill of Grace in a shop and I asked the salesperson how much it was because it didn't have a price, and that person had no idea anything about the wine, nothing. If I'd asked them about a French wine, they could have given me all the details. New Zealand wine is a little bit different. Like our production is generally a lot lower. So the New Zealand wine is pretty expensive in comparison to other countries. So it's more of a why. Is it more expensive? And once you get that message across about the sustainability, about the handmade aspect, about the small producers and the fact that the staff all get paid at least minimum wage instead of maybe getting abused a little bit like what unfortunately does happen in certain other countries, they can taste the wine and they can change their perception of the value. But obviously, if you're looking at a supermarket, you're not going to have a passionate sommelier there explaining these details. So that's kind of what our problem is. That's our mission over here, is to try and position New Zealand wine in a alternative to expensive wine from the States or France or Italy or Spain. I think that's where New Zealand wine should be positioned, and that's kind of what we're trying to do over here. During the lockdown, we've had a bit of a chance to reset. So I've spent time going off and finding very, very cool and interesting sake so that we can offer something that you can't necessarily get everywhere else. And that's partially because a lot of people in Japan are just they don't value sake. I sort of say it all the time. People over here will spend like $60-$70 on an average bottle of wine from Europe. But the idea of spending that much money on a bottle of sake, straight away in their head, they're like, I could just buy this from the supermarket. And so, well, first of all, you couldn't. And secondly, why do you think that the European wine is better than the sake just because you think you can buy it from the supermarket? It's actually fairly hard to run a business, I think, on the dollar value or the yen value that a lot of locals around here put on it, which is difficult and frustrating, but just, I guess, another challenge that needs to be overcome.
What about glassware? Are you serving in the traditional little cups that we were talking about before, or have you gone more for wine glasses?
Definitely like wine glasses. We're kind of more of a wine bar than a sake bar at the moment. So using wine glasses is a good way to kind of break somebody's preconceptions of those little cups being shot glasses. And obviously they're not shot glasses, they're just little cups. And the thing is also a lot of people, including Japanese, are a little bit shocked to see a sake served in a wine glass because they don't, it is a way of kind of getting them to associate it with something of a more quality, of a more premium product. I think one of the best things that started to happen in Sydney when I was bartending there is when people started serving tequila in a rocks glass. If you serve a tequila in a shot glass, people drink it like a shot. And if you serve it in a rocks glass, people look at it and kind of go, oh, and they're more inclined to just sip it. And I think, yeah, putting the sake in the wine glass, it gives you the opportunity to explain things like aromatics, and it gives you the opportunity to explain things like how your sense of flavor actually works. And it is an opportunity to provide an experience a little bit outside of what maybe the customer or the guest was expecting when they came through the door.
And when you opened the bar, like, were you expecting to be catering mainly for Japanese people or expats or tourists or a combination of all of the above?
The Rugby World Cup was, we had a lot of people coming through for the Rugby World Cup, especially on certain days when the New Zealand team was playing or Australia or Japan. But it was spread across the country, so it's not like everyone was just here for one time. Whereas the Olympics, being in Tokyo, everyone was going to be here for the 2-3 week period. That was something where we were sort of anticipating a huge influx of people who were interested in sake. Unfortunately, obviously, that's not going to pan out that way. We did originally expect to probably have a few more tourists, and down the line, I think that'll probably happen. But over time, probably for us, it is more the local wine community, the local Japanese wine community, that I think are the ones that we probably are trying to get through to, because I guess a lot of the expats already know we have good product. And so, like, if we can get more and more Japanese people to look at New Zealand, Australia as an alternative, as a very, very valuable, high value alternative to, say, high end French wine or American wine, then I think that's probably where the future lies for us.
And there is like a real growing kind of wine appreciation movement in Tokyo?
I remember hearing that Japan had the most sommeliers in the world, or wine certified, wine educated people in the world. Sommelier is maybe not the right word to use, but the and I think that's probably true. But it would appear to be very, very specifically focused on Europe and America. And so there's a lot of people who I've spoken to who are sommeliers who've never even tasted wine from New Zealand. And so we have that ability. You're talking to someone who generally understands. So my job is to ask them, what do they normally drink? And then I can make an alternative based on what we've got here and then sort of give them some background. But yeah, like, luckily we've got some pretty phenomenal wines that we can put on by the glass here. And so if people do understand wine, maybe the price is more expensive than some of the places around us. But if you understand wine and you taste it, then you realize it's actually cheaper than what it would be if it had a French label.
Yeah, sure. And when it comes to the sakis, how do you go about sourcing those? Is it about actually traveling around to breweries, or is it just based on things that you get to taste, you know, do reps come in and sell to you? How does all that sort of work?
Yeah, no, reps pretty much never come and visit. It's a very different from what I was kind of expecting after being in Australia and New Zealand. And sometimes when the reps from the Japanese companies, they'll invite you to a tasting and then tell you how much you have to pay. And sort of it's a surprise to get charged sort of $70 Australian to taste product they want you to sell for them.
Wayne's experience reminds me of the insights we heard from Shuso Imada about the Japanese sake industry back in season 2 of this podcast.
In each city, each town, or each village, there should be the brewery of sake and brewery of miso and soy sauce. And among those three, sake's family is usually the biggest. They're a rich family, so they are, you know, proud of themselves. And their attitude is like, if you want sake, we can sell it. Didn't really take so much of an effort to sell their products.
I think that's true, and partially that's because if they promote their business and I call them up, then they can't sell directly to me. I would have to still go. So it's kind of this interruption of what I think is probably a better practice, where you contact the producer and the producer sells it to you. Here it's kind of interrupted. So I think they don't even necessarily try in many cases. There are places that if you go to their tasting rooms, they're really, really generous. But a lot of the places they just don't. It's almost like that doesn't cross their mind. So what we've been doing recently, because the middle people are causing us a lot of frustration, so we'd rather now just go out and visit the brewery. We're going up to a sparkling brewery place in a couple of weeks up in, it's called Mizubasho, which is the sort of pioneers of the champagne method sake. And we went out to Narita Township a couple of months ago and found some of the best sake I've ever tasted. And we'd rather do that now. We're paying basically the same price as retail price at the shop, at the cellar door, for want of a better term. But at least then we've got things that we absolutely love, and at least then I guess the producer's taking the money as opposed to the middlemen. But we want to travel around now and find the breweries and visit them and speak to them, and then hopefully over time maybe the relationship will change. But yeah, it's a strange industry over here sometimes, and there's a lot of confusion if you're used to the way we do things back in New Zealand and Australia.
Look, you touched on sparkling sake, which is an interesting emerging style. Are there any other styles that you're particularly excited about at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, there's a massive thing going on with aged sake at the moment. When sake ages, it'll start to develop some pretty interesting sherry characteristics. There's some interesting, I guess, like soy sauce aspects or almost like Vegemite that'll come through, which is basically, I think, you're smelling umami. It's very interesting, especially from the food matching point of view. And if there's some residual sugar left in the product, it's almost like a very well-aged port or sherry, PX sherry. Whereas if they're quite dry, it's like an aged sherry as well. They're pretty fascinating. And it is also kind of breaking up some of those misconceptions, I think, where I know in Australia there is certain push that says that junmai sake or sake made from pure rice is better, whereas sake that has had brewer's alcohol is somehow some sort of adulteration of the product. And it's just not true. It's a misunderstanding of why the brewer is doing what they do. And one of the things that my wife and I, when we went out to Narita, we tasted these sakes, and one of them was a 21-year-old aged sake, like Honjozo, that had had added alcohol. And one was a junmai, just a pure rice sake that was 19 years old. And the added alcohol one was better. Like it was a much better product. And so these misconceptions that are out there, being in Japan, I guess, makes it easier for us to hopefully correct some of those. No one ever talks about fortified wine as being somehow an adulteration. It's just a different process. And it's exactly the same thing with sake made and with the added alcohol, is they're just doing something different. It's not good or bad. It's just different.
And it does help to elevate the aromatics of the sake as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And people think it's being done as a way of sort of bulking out the product. But like you say, alcohol carries aroma, so it adds flavor and character to the product sometimes.
And obviously we're talking about in the case of premium sake, not in the case of the cheaper sake where it probably is being used to
bulk it out. And that's kind of what causes some of the confusion. But I mean, again, I just put it back. It's like I just talked about sherry. They're adding alcohol to sherry and no one's complaining about it. I'm sure someone will be complaining about it, but no one's acting like it's some sort of abomination, which is some of the attitude that I got when I did visit Australia. People just didn't understand that it was not done with the wrong reasons. And it's also, I guess, important to say that the brewer will add water afterwards from the local source, to the same reason why you might add water to a cask strength whiskey, is to bring it down to what the brewer thinks is probably the best alcohol content for that product. So even though they do add alcohol during the process, it's not being done to increase the alcohol content of the product. It's pretty much unrelated.
Anything else in terms of, you know, sake styles?
Yeah, there's a few sakes that are sort of stepping outside of appellation control, for want of a better term. One that I've just received, which I think is a phenomenal product, and I don't think you could drink a lot of it because of the sweetness. When you make sake, right, you end up with something called kasu, which is basically the dead yeast and the rice solid that's left after the pressing. And it usually doesn't end up in the bottle, but if you've ever had cloudy sake, that's the reason why it's cloudy, is it's got the yeast and the dead yeast and some of the rice solids left in the bottle still. And so this brewery has started re-fermenting it and making sake out of the rice solids that was left behind. And it is just such a phenomenally complex, and it's just such a perfect way to finish a meal, I think, much the way that you get a sweet sherry or port is a perfect way to finish a meal. It's just absolutely fascinating. So I don't think that style necessarily has a name yet, but there is another style that does have a name, which is called Kijoshu. And basically what they do there, when they're normally adding water, they're adding sake. And you end up with a product that is fairly high in acidity and it's got a beautiful sweetness. Again, you could swap it out for a dessert wine and you'd be pretty happy. So there's some really, really interesting things going on there with people kind of just testing the boundaries, I think, much like the way that the craft beer industry has been testing the boundaries with different processes in the last sort of 20 years in particular.
What about in New Zealand wine? You know, are there any particular regions that are really exciting you at the moment? Regions or wine styles, I should say.
I think Hawke's Bay is just an amazing place. When you've got somewhere like Gimlet Gravels, and where you've got Cabernet, Merlot, Chardonnay, Tempranillo, all growing side by side. There's very few places in the world where that's going to happen. And Syrah as well. There's so many different things that are all happening in exactly the same place. And the quality of those wines, they're consistently in blind tastings, they stand up against what is considered the best in the world. And that's just talking about Gimlet Gravels. Tony Bush, his winery is actually in Napier, and his Chardonnays are getting amazing recognition. And then you've still got kind of like the other regions like Tiawanga or Te Mata. They're just amazing. Hawke's Bay is just producing some of the most amazing world-class wines, but I guess most people just hear about Marlborough. Not to say Marlborough doesn't, there's a reason why it's famous. It's just an amazing place. And I would not have called myself a Pinot Noir drinker up until recently, because I find a lot of Pinot to just be a little bit light and a little bit boring, for want of a better word. I tend to drink bigger, punchier things, you know, like those big Islay whiskies and stuff, like all the big Australian Cabernets. And so Pinot was not my natural friend. But if you go to Martinborough and you taste some of the Pinots from Martinborough up in Timuna Terrace, then just down in the village itself, those wines are just absolutely outstanding.
Good stuff, Wayne. And just finally, how are things going for you, during the pandemic, running a hospo business in Tokyo?
Yeah, it's been outstanding, as you can imagine. It's given me lots of opportunity to improve my Japanese and do some exercise. And
But you've been trading throughout for the most part, or...?
We've never ever completely closed. So we've got our local customers who come in here for the weekly soup or the daily soup, and I don't know what he'd do if we closed. So we've been staying open for the lunch service, but even when we're not been allowed to sell alcohol, we've just sort of been ticking through because we want to keep the visibility. But we've been doing other things. It's been a good reset for us. We're lucky enough that the money that the government is allocating us is relevant, and so we're not panicking yet. So we consider ourselves extremely lucky. We've got our regular customers who come in and buy bottles of New Zealand wine, which is enough to keep ticking things over. But we've kind of done our reset now, and we've sort of changed the menu, and we've found the wines that we wanted to, and now we're just getting pretty bored selling coffee and stuff. Pretty keen to get back into it. So hopefully that's very, very soon, because we really do think we've got the opportunity to push things forward much, much better now than maybe 2 years ago.
Well, I hope that does happen, and I hope I can get over there, because it's been way too long since I've been to Tokyo. Best of luck with it all, and can't wait to see you over there at some stage.
No, thank you very much, James. I really appreciate the time.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.